It is Monday, February the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, more tough words between Israel and Iran.
It is a war of words, but it's a war of words that's for quite a few years now been increasingly borne out.
Also ahead, rallies in aftermath of that mass shooting at a U.S. high school.
We're really sad because of the people who died, because this is a school and there's not really supposed to be, like, bad people here shooting and killing people.
We'll have social media response to all of that, plus a look at one of the stars of country music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. At the Munich Security Conference in Germany over the weekend, U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster noted the tensions in the Middle East between Israel and Iran and the rest of the region are on the rise because of Iranian behavior in Syria and elsewhere in the region.
We know that Syria and North Korea are not the only rogue states developing, using, spreading dangerous weapons. Now is the time to address serious flaws in the Iran deal and counter Iran's destabilizing activities, including its development and proliferation of missiles and its support for terrorist proxies and militias.
And later on, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel could act against Iran itself, not just its allies in the Middle East, after border incidents in Syria, which brought the Middle East foes closer to a direct confrontation. Iran mocked Netanyahu's tough words, saying Israel's reputation for invincibility had crumbled after one of its jets was shot down following a bombing run in Syria, which followed an alleged Iranian drone entering Israeli territory from Syria. Well, the war of words between Netanyahu and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif took place at that Munich conference. Zarif said Israel uses aggression as a policy against its neighbors with mass reprisals and daily incursions into Syria and Lebanon. VOA's Victor Beatty sought some insight into all of this from Benham Ben Talablu. He's an Iranian analyst at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.
It is a war of words, but it's a war of words that's for quite a few years now been increasingly borne out in terms of low-intensity conflict through a series of proxies, militias, and client states that Iran has. So, yes, there is a general Iranian encroachment onto the Levant and onto the Eastern Med. This is part of the long-standing attempt by the Islamic Republic to project power well beyond its borders, create several sources of deterrence against Israel, and to bolster the forces that ultimately covet Israel's destruction. So I think the commentary between Netanyahu and Zarif at this conference largely speaks for itself. Of course, the Iranians always deny these actions. The Israelis always cite the material evidence for these types of actions. And then, you know, you kind of have an escalatory row between the two.
This is all related to the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. There is a report that the U.S. has sketched out a path under which three European allies would commit to try to improve the Iran nuclear deal over time in return for President Trump's keeping the pact alive by renewing a sanctions relief in May. How likely do you think that is, and how significant is it?
I mean, I think that's a 50-50. I mean, I think the president said absent real modifications or absent real progress on two fronts, you know, the home front where in the Congress, in the Senate in particular, there's the attempt to amend and rewrite INARA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. You know, this is the piece of legislation that, you know, basically implements the Iran deal through the prism of U.S. legislation. And then abroad, there's a desire for the U.S. to have the European allies, particularly the Germans, the French, and the Brits, to tighten their stance on Iran, to make sure they deal with Iran's non-nuclear threats, and for them to get serious on the fatal flaws of this deal. So progress on those two fronts has been not that great so far. But again, there's always room for cautious optimism.
According to this State Department cable and this senior department official who was quoted, the three elements basically that the U.S. wants to see improved have to do, as you mentioned, with long-range ballistic missile testing, IAEA inspections, and the so-called sunset clause that needs to, quote-unquote, be fixed. How likely would Iran agree to such changes?
I mean, it really depends how you frame those changes. And in particular, I don't like to usually read cables that are leaked just for the purposes of respect for the men and women that work in the U.S. government. But I could largely understand why these would be the three issues, because these are the three issues that have been in the public eye between the U.S. and Iran basically since the implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action nuclear deal. I have one issue with the long-range ballistic missile testing. It is particularly important for me that all of Iran's ballistic missile arsenal be included in a concerted pressure campaign by the Europe and the United States. And I say all of the arsenal because, you know, the former directors of national intelligence have said that Iran's ballistic missiles are inherently capable of delivering WMD. And, you know, former directors of national intelligence have also said that, you know, if Iran was ever going to develop a nuclear weapon, it would be ballistic missiles. The delivery vehicle for those weapons would be via ballistic missile. So ignoring that most likely delivery vehicle to me doesn't make sense.
How likely, based upon what you heard in Munich on Sunday, will the tensions between Israel and Iran move beyond just a war of words?
In many ways, they've already been escalating beyond words. I think that finally the words are beginning to catch up to the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is in neighboring Syria, Iran has long used the cover of the Syrian civil war as a way to rearm its key Lebanese proxy, Lebanese Hezbollah. You know, everyone who's been watching Iran knows that Iran now has this diverse array of militias who are Arab. They're from Iraq. They're from Syria. Iran has South Asian Shiites from Pakistan and Afghanistan fighting on its behalf, furthering the ideological mission in Syria. But I think the most successful export to date of the Iranian revolutionary model remains Lebanese Hezbollah. And that's why the threat from Lebanese Hezbollah is so potent, not just to Israel, but also now to Lebanon. Lebanese Hezbollah intervened decisively on Iran's behalf and on Assad's behalf in Qusair in 2013 in Syria, turning the tide of that battle and ultimately helping Assad win back some select territory. Then once you take the Revolutionary Guard Corps, Lebanese Hezbollah, the Shia militias, and the Assad army, and then you couple that with Russian air power, that's why the Assad regime has been on the offensive for so long. You know, they have this robust machinery behind them that is committed to keeping Assad in power. And unlike the West, which has been supporting select Syrian rebels, that resolve has not shaken.
Benham Ben Talablu is an Iranian analyst at the Foundations for the Defense of Democracies. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. In the wake of last week's high school shooting that killed 17 people in the U.S. city of Parkland, Florida, community members took part in anti-gun rallies over the weekend. This girl is a senior at the school where 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz killed students and teachers last week.
Despite being tipped off to the FBI multiple times, he was able to legally purchase an AR-15. He was able to legally purchase that semi-automatic rifle and come into my school and slaughter 17 of my people. Because of these gun laws, people that I know, people that I love have died, and I will never be able to see them again.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is calling for a review of how authorities deal with tips about a masked gunman who might be trying to carry out such an attack. On Sunday, thousands of people in the Parkland area gathered to remember the victims. 9-year-old Camila Valladares was one of them.
We're really sad because of the people who died, because this is a school and there's not really supposed to be, like, bad had people here shooting and killing people because it's a school for teenagers, so it's not really fair. I'm sorry for your loss. Your child was too young, and they were not supposed to die in this because it's not fair that people should die in this.
Anti-white supremacists also took part in Sunday's demonstration. Angelica Grindel is a member of the American Civil Liberty Union's local chapter.
Our kids, and it's all of our kids at this point, died right there in a community that people thought was safe. And every time one of these happens, we refuse to look at the underlying problems. We have a problem with toxic masculinity. We have a problem with white supremacy. If we had mass shooters that were black, we would be saying it's black identity extremism. If they were Muslim, we'd be calling it Islamic terrorism. If they were brown, we'd talk about immigration and building a damn wall. But when they're white, we say it's a lone gunman. We say it's an isolated incident. It's not. We need to talk about this. We cannot be silent. Our kids need us to speak out.
And as you might imagine, the world of social media has been abuzz ever since last Wednesday's mass shooting at that high school in Parkland, Florida. VOA's Lori London here now with what's being said.
Well, Steve, students who escaped the deadly school shooting in Florida are rising up, and they're using lots of social media to do it. They've turned their grief into anger, and much of it has been focused on lawmakers, Congress, and President Trump. Not only are they pushing for action to prevent more mass shootings, many reacted with anger, specifically at Donald Trump's initial response to the shooting, which was to tweet a message of support for victims and shift focus on the shooter's mental health history rather than on gun laws. One student tweeted, "We don't need your expletive prayers. Get better gun control." And they've also been responding to a slew of tweets over the weekend by the president. On the same day as the heartbreaking funerals, the president tweeted Saturday that Democrats hadn't passed any gun control measures during the brief time they controlled Congress. Trump also alluded to the FBI's failure to act on tips that the suspect was dangerous, while bemoaning the Bureau's focus on Russia's role in the 2016 election. And this only raised the level of outrage from students who called him out again. One of them tweeting, quote, 17 innocent people were brutally murdered at my school, a place where they should have felt safe. Their lives were gone in an instant. You are the president of the United States, and you have the audacity to put this on Russia as an excuse. I guess I should expect that from you. Well, the teens refused also to give a right-wing activist any leeway when she, too, tried to deflect a renewed national discussion on gun control, tweeting, can the left let the families grieve for even 24 hours before they push their anti-gun and anti-gun owner agenda? My goodness, this isn't about a gun. It's about another lunatic. Well, the response was fast and furious from students again. Here's one example. I was hiding in a closet for 2 hours. It was about guns. You weren't there. You don't know how it felt. Guns give these disgusting people the ability to kill other human beings. This is about guns, and this is about all the people who had their life abruptly ended because of guns. And Steve, we also know now that organizers behind the Women's March have called for a 17-minute, in honor of the 17 victims, nationwide walkout by teachers and students on March 14th. And the Network for Public Education and Advocacy Organization for Public Schools announced a day of walkouts and other events on school campuses on April 20th. That's the anniversary of the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado that left 12 students and one teacher dead. Now, these Florida students have vowed to become the face of a movement for tighter firearm regulations. They're calling for anti-gun violence demonstrations in Washington and other big cities on March 24th, emerging as hashtag March for Our Lives. And Steve, former Arizona Representative Gabrielle Giffords, herself the victim of a shooting rampage and a strong advocate for gun control laws, retweeted the post about the event, March for Our Lives, and retweeted a post about the march saying, "Our children shouldn't have to march in the streets to demand that we keep them safe. I'm so proud of the courageous students from Parkland for organizing and demanding action. Let's help them fight for a safer future." Steve?
Many thanks to you, Lori. That is VOA's Lori London. We're going to move on now to delivery robots, which could one day be part of the landscape of cities all around the world. Among the latest to be developed is an Italian-made model that drives itself around town and drops off packages. Since the machine runs on electricity, its developers say it is an environmentally friendly alternative to fuel-powered delivery vehicles that cause pollution. We get more now from VOA's Deborah Block.
This delivery robot called Yape is making its way around the streets of Cremona in northern Italy. The robot uses sensors and a GPS to maneuver and can travel about 50 kilometers on one charge. Yape was created in response to the expanding urban delivery market, says the robot's co-creator.
Yape can reach its destination in a matter of minutes. It can work for 24 hours in any weather conditions. Because it self-drives on sidewalks and cycling paths, it avoids traffic accidents.
An app tells Yape where to pick up and deliver a package. The Android identifies the sender through a built-in face recognition algorithm. The person receiving the package can use the app to track the robot's movements. Yape sends a message to the recipient with a specific time to pick up the package outside. The machine has surveillance cameras, so if someone tries to steal packages by forcing the lid open, it will send an alert to a remote control center. This Italian tourist likes the delivery robot.
Yes, I would use Yape in place of a human courier, or as an alternative to a van that increases pollution and parking problems.
Enovia is exploring the possibility of using the robot for other purposes, such as transporting objects inside a building or factory.
For example, such as delivering drugs in a hospital or to deliver documents in a library.
The firm hopes to put Yape on the market next year. Deborah Block, VOA News.
And many thanks to you, Debbie. Still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of country music sensation Brett Eldridge. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Thanks to data from NASA's K2 mission, an international team of scientists led by Andrew Mayo of the National Space Institute at the Technical University of Denmark have recently discovered 95 more exoplanets. Sifting through a list of some 275 candidates, the researchers were able to validate 149 of them as actual exoplanets. According to the research team, it turns out that 95 of these planets are actually new exoplanet discoveries. The K2 mission was developed by NASA after serious technical problems with the Kepler spacecraft in 2012 and 2013 threatened to end the original Kepler mission. So instead of giving up, NASA proposed a modification and extension of its mission, called it K2, which has been operating ever since. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now a little something from the world of music.
Just met you a couple hours ago, my last night in town. Hey, wouldn't you know, I'd get hooked on a girl with blue diamond eyes down here in Mexico. Oh, now you're walking up asking me to dance, smiling that smile and reaching out your
Eldridge is an American country music singer, songwriter, and record producer, and one of the hot new singers on the scene. He's the cousin of Terry Eldridge of the bluegrass band, the Grascals. Eldridge had 3 number one singles on the Billboard Country Airplay chart, all from his debut album. Beat of the Music was one of them.
Got my heart racing like there's nothing to
Waking up on the beach, if you know what I'm saying. One more night would be more than all right with me. So hold on, baby, 'cause you got the soul and you know how to use it. Put your hand on my hip, 'cause you know that I lose it. You got my heart racing like there's nothing to it. Falling in love to the beat of the music. We're falling in love to the beat of the music.
In 2016, Eldridge was selected as one of 30 artists to perform on Forever Country. That was a mashup of songs celebrating 50 years of the Country Music Association Awards. And in March of 2017, he released a new album with the breakout single, The Long Way, which made it all the way to the top of the charts.
Don't think I've ever seen your kind of pretty. Wandering around this midnight madhouse city. You got a look that says you got it all together. So if you don't mind, I'd like to know you better. Take me the long way around your town. Were you the queen with the silver crown? I want the secrets you keep, the shine underneath of the diamond I think I just found. Take me.
Songs are often described as the best of songs about relationships breaking up. Well, true or not, Eldridge's hit, One Mississippi, certainly qualifies for that description.
One Mississippi, two Mississippi, counting down the seconds, standing in the wreckage of love. On a cold gray Jackson dawn. Oh, I just can't watch this show, can't stop this. I keep waiting, your taillights are fading. I see you're already gone. I'm half of who I used to be. One Mississippi. Lipstick on a coffee cup. I know I should wash it up, but maybe I just wait here for a little while. Run my fingers round the top where your lips were. I just stop, 'cause I can almost see.
Super hit for Brett Eldridge, One Mississippi. Well, as you know, the Winter Olympics are underway in South Korea, and you can stay on top of what's going on there at our website, voanews.com. We have the latest medal count. We thank you for joining us today here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Top World News is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a great Monday. And now let's listen to a little bit more from Brett Eldridge.
And it's one Mississippi, two Mississippi, counting down the seconds, standing in the wreckage of love on a cold gray Jackson dawn. Oh, I just can't watch this show, can't stop this, I keep waiting. Your taillights are faded, I see you're already gone. I'm half of who I used to be. One Mississippi.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of February, Americans celebrate President's Day, when Americans honor all their national leaders, past and present. The day was originally meant to honor the first president and arguably the country's most influential founder, George Washington, who was born on February 22, 1732. The date became an annual, unofficial day of remembrance in the year 1800, the year after President Washington died. It finally became a federal holiday in 1885. Since then, about half the states have modified the observance to include the celebration of another president. On this day, about half the U.S. states also commemorate the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. It is a fitting choice. Born on February 12, 1809, Lincoln, like Washington, was enormously influential in the foundation and development of the United States. Washington led the rebel army that won the country's independence from the British crown, put the nation on a sound financial footing, and led the young United States of America through the initial labor pains that quickly gave birth to a stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, and by ensuring the peaceful transfer of power to the leader elected to succeed him, George Washington set an important precedent for all future presidents. Lincoln, on the other hand, was the glue that held together a country torn by a vicious civil war and set the stage for a peacetime shift in power distribution between federal and state government entities. Ultimately, his actions turned a loose federation of states united under a weak central government into a true union headed by a strong federal government. This change began with slavery laws. Prior to the Civil War, some states allowed slavery by law. Others outlawed slavery. On January 1, 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, abolishing slavery in the rebellious states. This led to the passage of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery nationwide. We honor Presidents Washington and Lincoln because they embodied the values and character that ennobles public service. On President's Day, we honor presidents past and present as they continue to uphold their oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.